of Jesus, and people say, well, aren't you one of his people? And he is very quick to say, I don't know who this guy is. I don't know what you're talking about. And maybe not the worst thing that he does, but also not a great look, is that he curses at a little girl. So we've got a bunch of things here about Peter. Again, we could add more to that list in which we look at Peter and say, here's a deeply flawed man, but we get the resurrection story. And Peter meets the resurrected Christ. And he has this scales fall from the eyes moment where he recognizes what Jesus has been about and now what he is to be about. And we go from there to Acts 2. And now here's Peter in front of thousands of people boldly proclaiming the truth of Jesus' messiahship. And then we go into from that where he's now being hounded by the religious authorities and he's bold and says, we're going to obey God rather than men. And he is a man of great faith and courage and conviction. But his flaws did not melt away. So let's look at Galatians 2. Here he's confronted by Paul. And Paul writes, but when Cephas, Peter, came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he began to withdraw and to hold himself aloof, fearing the party of the circumcision. The rest of the Jews joined him in hypocrisy, with the result that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in the presence of all, if you, being a Jew, live like the Gentiles and not like the Jews, how is it that you compel the Gentiles to live like Jews? And we'll pause it there. So here is Peter showing himself to, again, be a flawed human being. Same Peter that preached on Pentecost. Same Peter that in Acts 12, when he's hounded by Herod, and he's told to stop what he's doing, and James is killed, and Peter still does not back down under the threat of imprisonment and death. That's the Peter we're talking about. Here in Antioch, though, the same flaws we meet in the Gospels come back, where he doesn't understand here something very fundamental about what Jesus' mission and work was about, the type of church that was meant to exist. That flaw continues. The flaw of hypocrisy and caring so much what other people think about him comes back in Antioch. And so both of these realities about Peter, the boldness and the courage of Acts 2 and Acts 12, sit right along the same individual we meet in Galatians 2. And we could add examples of people like this in the Gospels. Quite a number of examples. People that did tremendous amounts of good, were instrumental in God's plan, and that we look up to as heroes of the faith, who also, upon reading their biographies, did a tremendous act of evil or multiple acts of evil. So again, just a handful. You have David, the man after God's own heart, who also proves himself, at least one time, to be a rapist and a murderer. Or you have Solomon, the great temple builder, the wise man, who also is a polygamist and an idolater. And you run that same story through Noah and Abraham and Jacob and Moses and on and on and on. We are confronted by this reality that the people we look up to the most are also capable of committing great acts of evil and disappointment. Now again, for clarity's sake, that's not to then give us the excuse to say, well, I mean, yeah, David had that guy murdered, but think of all the other good stuff that David did. So is that murder really that big of a deal? Because that's not how Nathan treats it. Or if we think about Peter in Antioch, Paul's response to Peter's hypocrisy and destructive behavior isn't, yeah, but this is the same guy that did Acts 2, so I guess like we'll let him have a little bit of flaws. In all of those stories, their evil is confronted and condemned. This is not weighing the scales of a person's life and saying, well, they did a lot of good things, and so we're all entitled to do a couple of bad things. If that's the conclusion we draw, we didn't read the stories. It's instead to say, to more realized reality. People that we look up to and respect and do great things in the plan of God also turn out to be majorly flawed. Now let's look at the reverse of a not as bad guy. And I want to take as our example of this Caiaphas. We'll be looking at John 11 if you want to start making your way in that direction. So we know Caiaphas from the Gospels as the high priest. And he is one of the group, if not the leader of the group, that is orchestrating the death of Jesus. And, you know, as you look at that story, without Caiaphas playing an active role, who knows how it sort of goes at the end. But it's Caiaphas there really driving this train to have Jesus executed. And I think we would all agree that the purposeful execution of an innocent person, I think we would classify that as murder, like a state-sanctioned murder. That's what Caiaphas does. He organizes the execution of an innocent man. A horrific act of evil. Horrific. And so we could look at Caiaphas and say, well, why does Caiaphas do that? Right? Why would he execute an innocent person? And we might chalk up to him a bunch of evil motives, right? Well, he's jealous of Jesus. He's arrogant and doesn't want to admit that he's wrong, so he wants to kill his rival. Or he's so concerned about, like, his own wealth and power, he doesn't want to be demoted. And so he builds upon his evil by having this guy executed. But John, when he talks about Caiaphas' motives, he reveals something different about his line of thinking. That doesn't make it so cut and dry, I think, how to think about Caiaphas. So here's what John records, this meeting between the Jewish leaders with Caiaphas taking a lead role. It says, therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council, and they were saying, what are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come, and they will take away both our place and our nation. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish. Now he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. So what motivates Caiaphas? Caiaphas is motivated by saving lives. That here is Jesus. Okay, so let's get in Caiaphas's headspace. Let's try to put ourselves in his shoes. You've got this person, Jesus of Nazareth, that for a long time, people have been pointing to and saying, here is the Messiah. And I think by this point, it's becoming pretty clear to the public that Jesus himself is putting himself forward as Messiah. So here's Caiaphas, he's got a Messiah figure in front of him. And you know what people expected the Messiah to do. They expected the Messiah to show up, to raise a mighty army, to engage in a war against the Roman occupiers, and to drive them out from the land through a massive bloody campaign. So Caiaphas is looking, well, here's a Messiah. What happens when Messiahs show up? People die. Jews die. Caiaphas does not have to look very far back into his experiences to know that's the case. About a decade and a half before Jesus, a man named Judas the Galilean leads a revolt against Rome. How did that end? With the massive slaughter of thousands. What happens after Jesus when messiahs show up? The slaughter of thousands, whether that's this man who is just known as the Egyptian or Theudas, thousands die. What happens in the revolt in AD 66 through 70? Jerusalem is destroyed, and Josephus says they ran out of wood to crucify people around the city. People die when messiahs show up. And at least some of the people in Jesus' orbit think that's what Jesus is going to do too. They also think he's going to engage in that type of warfare. So now you're Caiaphas. You are hearing these reports of here is a messianic figure that is gathering the crowds together. And it says he is concerned that the nation will die, that Rome will come and slaughter. And so he says it's better for us to have this one person killed and save thousands of lives. He makes a utilitarian calculus, right? One death is better than a thousand deaths. And so he plans to have Jesus killed. So what does this say about Caiaphas? Is what he did horrifically evil? Yes. And should never be dismissed as anything but a horrific evil to be condemned. But when you look at his thought process, he was doing what he thought was right. And also was motivated by a principle that I think we agree with, that we don't want people to die. And yet it led him to accomplish what he thought was good through an evil means. And we could, again, multiply examples of things like this on and on, of people that were either committing great acts of evil, were sort of what we might classify as evil people, also ended up doing things that were good and beneficial for the people of God. Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus, Xerxes, Herod Agrippa, the centurion soldiers that are occupying Judea, Zacchaeus, who had been committing acts of fraud for years, turn out to surprise us in the things that they're able to do. And maybe we're surprised by Caiaphas's concern for others rather than being purely motivated by a concern for self. So if you'll indulge me, two messages I want to emphasize from this. One I think is maybe the most obvious. Learning to possess a humility in our judgment. So if all we had known, say, of Caiaphas was had an innocent person executed, or if all we knew about Peter, say, was Acts 2 or Acts 12, we would draw from that conclusions or kind of macro views of their lives that would not be warranted by the evidence, that there's more there to consider. And it's very easy and tempting for us to think that we have people figured out. You know, well, I really know what this person's about. I really know who they are because I know some of these details. So that could work itself out in a couple of ways. One way that could work itself out is we look at somebody doing something good or kind or Christ-like, and we say, well, there, I mean, that is the picture of Christian discipleship, right? They are the shining example, and so we construct the pedestal for them, and we place them up on the pedestal, and we can just gaze lovingly at all of the great things that they do, and then are shocked when it turns out, well, no, they're flawed also. Just because we put them on a pedestal didn't make them perfect. They can have a bad attitude. They can mistreat people. They can engage in hypocrisy. They can engage in destructive actions. And when we put people on a pedestal and we fail to acknowledge their complexity, it makes that fall both harder for them and for us. And we set ourselves up and them for disappointment. And then relationships have trouble recovering because we had painted this picture of them that was not really warranted in the first place. I posit, though, that's probably not our biggest struggle. Because increasingly we are becoming cynical. We don't really trust people very much, and so maybe I'm not going to be so quick to build you up. Maybe I'm going to be much more likely to distrust you. And so then we get into a situation, kind of the reverse of that, of, well, I've seen this person, they said something really mean to me, or I found some hypocrisy in their teachings and actions, or I find something that I think that they believe that I think is wrong, or I've seen them commit an act of sin or struggle with sin in their lives. And so now I can take from these flaws that I've identified and draw back from that. Well, they're just terrible. They're just a monster. They're just evil. Who's to save this person? I can have nothing to do with them now. And that gets into all sorts of things about what motivates a person, what their intentions are, all these sorts of things that become quite difficult for us to know. But by fixating so much on flaws to the exclusion of the things about them that are praiseworthy and that we should love and cherish, by focusing on the flaws, no relationship can really exist there. Any hope for a church working in harmony together has just disappeared when we start identifying people as, well, they are the problem and I'm on the right side over here. And failing to see that they could be like Caiaphas, doing something that's bad, believing something that is wrong, but attempting to achieve ends that are good and praiseworthy. Right? I hope I'm conveying what I want to. Not to dismiss the flaws, ignore the flaws, or to think that the sin isn't a big deal, but to remember they are human beings worthy of our love too. If that's still not clear, ask me about it later and I'll try it again. But a third option of how this may work itself out. And this may just be like my problem, it may not be your problem. So if I'm projecting onto you something, forgive me. If you think about the people that we know and come across, how much do we really know about them? People that I work with, what do I really know about their lives? The students I have in class, what do I really know about their... I may know some things, right? I interact with them, so I see that. I may know some things about what it's like at home. And so I think in that principle we can understand there's a lot about a person we don't know. And I think that is can be just as true of people in the church. You know, we see a person 1 or 2 hours a week. Well, how much do we really know about them? Or what they're thinking, or what they're trying to accomplish, or what are they doing when they're out of sight? And what becomes easy to do in that situation is, well, what I don't see happening must not be happening at all. So I don't see them when I come across, I don't see them doing things that are loving. I don't see them being forgiving. I don't see them being generous to the poor and the sick. Or I don't see them spending time in study and reflection on their beliefs. And so because I don't see that, it must not be happening. That's really just sort of a judgment from ignorance. Assuming that because I don't see that it's there, it must not be there. Which is, to be honest with you, I think a lot of what happened when I was reading those biographies. You know, I knew, like, the highlights of their life, the major things, and so I could scratch the surface, but then when you start to plunge deeper, you find an entire well of knowledge underneath that changes the view. So we should not adopt a position of, again, maybe I'm just projecting, and forgive me, of, well, I don't see these things happening, therefore, say, they don't take their faith as seriously as me, or the church as seriously as me. And to have that attitude merely will breed resentment and hatred and division and ultimately the destruction of the body. And so instead, adopting a humility in our judgment, I think, is a much wiser course that will allow for stronger relationships. So one example of this, we can look in James 4. You could look in Matthew 7 in the words of Jesus. Also, kind of a consistent theme. James, let's look at James 4 and begin in verse 10. Where he says, "To humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you. Do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There is only one lawgiver and one judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor?" Indulge me again to stress. I don't think it's James's point. I don't think it's Jesus's point. It's not my point. That, well, I'm not supposed to judge, so that when I see a person abusing a child, who am I to judge? That's not how Paul treats Peter. It rather is to say do I value this person as a human being that is redeemable, you know, that can be better than what they are? Or have I written them off and I have judged them to be beyond repair and now am distancing myself from them completely? Now, again, sorry. I also want to say, you know, I think if we spent some time, we could think about, well, Jared, now are you saying like a guy like Hitler or Ted Bundy? Like, well, are we supposed to be looking for redeeming qualities about them? For the time being, let's put those figures aside and let's acknowledge you and I do not meet people like that. I hope not. If you do, if you know somebody like that, tell somebody about that. Don't keep that to yourself. But because we can recognize, well, sure, there are people. It drives me nuts. Now I'm sorry. See, this is what happens when you're in the second service. I start going off. It drives me nuts in class when we get to World War II and a kid says, yeah, but Hitler was great for the economy. You don't need to make excuses for people's wrongdoing. We don't need to say, well, we've all got flaws. But it's to understand this person is loved by God too and should be loved by me. And what are the things that, imagine going to Caiaphas and saying, look, Caiaphas, you want to save people's lives. I want to save people's lives. That's a much better starting point than, Caiaphas, you're a hypocritical, arrogant, selfish, evil person. Now do what I want you to do. Right? It's acknowledging the good that is in them. One final point. So a lot of that was about kind of how we look at other people. What about how people look at us? And we may feel or think that we have found ourselves in a position where people only see our flaws, or they only assume we're not engaged in Christian practices and Christian discipleship. Now, that could be right or it could be wrong. You know, we maybe are telling ourselves people don't respect us and don't like us when that's really not the case. It may be a faulty conclusion to draw, or it may be the right conclusion to draw, right? Maybe people really are doing that to us. I think in many respects, though, it's a little irrelevant, because if you really do feel that way, that would be an incredibly lonely, frustrating, painful position to be in. And if you felt like all people saw in you was what was wrong with you and couldn't acknowledge the good things that you're engaged in, the godly things that you're engaged in, that would be very frustrating and hard to keep doing what was right. So we may find ourselves in that position. And I want to acknowledge that that's painful. And I don't want, with what I'm about to say, that somehow that diminishes the pain that is felt in that position. And that we ought to be supporting people who maybe find themselves that way, whether it's true or not. Whether people really are just focusing on the flaws. But to be there to support those people. So I don't want what I'm about to say to diminish the pain. But it is necessary in those moments to realize and remember that the God who created heaven and earth, and the God that created you, He sees the real you. Flaws and all, He sees you. Not a caricature of you, not a couple of details here and there, not the gossip of the bad things people are saying about you. God sees you. And He loves you with an infinite, inexhaustible love for you. Hebrews 4. I want to look at this passage, which might be terrifying, but is also one of great comfort, I think. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 12. It says, "For the word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, and piercing as far as the division of the soul and spirit, of both joints and marrow, and able to judge the thoughts and intentions of the heart. And there is no creature hidden from His sight, but all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of Him with whom we have to do. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, and yet without sin. So while the notion of having your life laid bare before God might be terrifying, because we are, for at least a time, can be very good at deceiving others and hiding things from people. I think ultimately those things have a tendency to reveal themselves and come out, but we can try and we can prolong the inevitable. There is no prolonging that with God, right? It is laid bare before Him. He sees all of the things that we're trying to hide. And that might be terrifying for us. It also, though, is incredibly comforting to know that God sees me in my entirety. He sees the flaws, and He sees the hypocrisy, but He sees the desire to do right and the hope for the future, that God is able to recognize that, He sees that, and I find that comforting. So if you find yourself in the position this morning where you feel like those around you have merely zeroed in on your flaws, your deficiencies, or are accusing you of things that you feel like are not warranted by the actual biography of your life, take comfort in knowing your life is laid bare in front of God. You and I think it's safe to say, are flawed individuals. That may be the understatement of the morning. We have flaws. Some of them are very deep and entrenched. But we are also people of great potential and capable of great good and righteousness and love. But not capable of that potential as if tomorrow you and I will wake up and say, you know what, today I'm going to start doing the right thing. And then from that day forward, things are just a breeze. If that's your intention for the morning, good luck with that. I'm not sure that's a recipe for success. Our potential does not lie in marshaling our own resources better tomorrow than we did today. Our potential for great acts of love and righteousness comes from the God who created us in His image, who on the cross died and then was resurrected, who has sent the Spirit to empower us. Our potential for great, righteous, loving, holy things comes from Him. And your life is laid bare before Him this morning. And if you recognize, well, if God is reading my biography, then He knows that I've done things that I've hurt people, and that has hurt Him, that has disappointed and brought shame. But that God's love didn't go away after He picked up your biography. That love has remained, and His desire to have you know Him and for Him to forgive you remains. And if you also need the comfort of knowing, because you feel isolated or alone, or you feel like nobody appreciates you, to know that God does, and we do, and we are here to support you. If you need to come forward, we invite you to do so as we stand and sing.